Thank you, Marcus, for inviting me to tell you about this. It almost feels a little bit, even though it's only a week old, like old news, because it's been of such a great interest to everybody. But I hope this is an opportunity for you to ask questions that I probably don't know the answers to. But I'm happy to actually sit and dig online for the answers if I think it's possible to do so. So we can, you know, make it more of an open discussion about these issues. It's still very much relevant for the media these days. I don't know if you saw the New York Times article by Dennis Overby today. It's worth it, if only for this bizarre cartoon. But I'm not sure why we're shooting the accelerators with cannons, but kind of interesting. Anyway, this talk I gave a week ago at PANIC. It was a talk just on the Standard Model Higgs search at CMS, and to this I've added a bit more material, the ATLAS combined Standard Model Higgs result, which was shown the same day, and then the Tevatron combined Standard Model Higgs result, which came out on Friday of last week. That was new at PANIC. And then I'll also talk a little bit about the MSSM Higgs result from CMS, which is a pretty amazing result, if you haven't seen that yet. And I've worked on that personally, so I know the answers to all those questions. So this is actually the only really new plot to talk, and it was generated this morning from the data we've collected so far. The LHC is up to nearly 1.8 inverse femtobarns delivered. The data that I'll talk about today are up through the June 28th shutdown, which began right here and correspond to 1.1 inverse femtobarns. So that was a huge increase over last year's sample of 36 inverse femtobarns, and gave us this, you know, dramatic improvement in the sensitivity for Standard Model Higgs search. So it's the game is really on at the LHC now. But the game is not over at the Tevatron, too, is the other message I want to leave you with. Just to remind you about CMS, the two most distinct features of CMS that are relevant to this are the large radius all-silicon tracker, much of which was built right here at UCSB in the beautiful silicon lab. The tracker outer barrel modules were built here. And then the lead tungstate state crystal electromagnetic calorimeter, which lies alongside, along with the hadron calorimeter, inside the superconducting solenoid, which has this really large field, 4 tesla. So B L squared gives us really good tracking resolution in CMS, and the ECAL has very good energy resolution, as you'll see when we talk about Higgs to gamma gamma. The biggest challenge so far this year, I would say, where people's effort really went, was in trying to accommodate the fact that in the high luminosity running, we have, for example, in this event, up to 8-10 interactions per crossing. The average during the luminosity period we'll talk about today was about 5.6 interactions per crossing. So out of these, out of this mess, you've got to pick out the correct one for the event. And also correct your various experimental observables for the fact that there's extra energy coming from the other interactions, largely minimum bias events, obviously, but still an important effect to worry about. So we study our efficiencies and fake rates as a function of what we call the pileup in the event, and reweight and correct for that. Well, that's a good question. It depends on how they get to full luminosity. If they go to 25 nanosecond crossing, that will spread it out more, right? But if they stay with a 50 nanosecond bunch crossing, then we may have to eat quite a large number of interactions per event, perhaps 25 to 30. I don't know the answer to the question, but it's hard to predict the future, but something like that.
So they don't have a definite plan now how they're going to
do it? I don't know what the plan is at the moment. They've just recently, just in the last week or so, been having trouble, you know, hanging on to the beam in the machine. They haven't solved that yet, to my knowledge.
What's the distance between the interaction points?
The luminous region is about 8 centimeters long. So it's a Gaussian, something like that. But you know, we have micron, you know, 10 microns, 20 microns precision.
Yeah, think about the ability of measuring space vertices. If you have some new long-lived particles.
How long lived? The longer lived, the better. Meter size? Centimeter size. That I don't think pileup is hurting our B tagging a bit. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's all transverse. The beam is, you know, 30 microns in diameter, so.
So we thought about this a little bit for the vector like SU2 doublets. And so the issue is more just, I mean, the problem is there's only basically three hits to make your track if it's just in a precision tracker. And then it's got to be a lot more longer before it makes it to any of the outer trackers. And the question, which I don't know the answer to, is just how much sort of random lining up of three hits will there be that looks like tracks? Because that's the major background.
Fake tracks, yeah.
Yeah, but it's a completely experimental one. It's not one you can simulate. I mean, it's really just accidental.
That's about what we call occupancy. How many essentially
so
random hits
there
are.
Yeah, it would be nice if someone did that study, because there are these short-lived tracks, and the only way we're going to find them is by this.
So far, we're doing quite well in accommodating the intensities we've been dealing with. So as you are probably all expert in, the production of Higgs at the LHC is dominated by this gluon fusion diagram involving a fermion loop, and that's the blue curve shown here. And you know, compared to the Tevatron, for example, which relies heavily on associated production of Higgs and vector bosons, those modes are quite suppressed at the LHC, relatively speaking, because it's a proton-proton collider. The next highest rate mode is, in fact, vector boson fusion, which the diagram for this looks like this. Only these two processes will play a role in what I show you today. In the future, however, we will make use of the associated production of Higgs with a vector boson. Rule of thumb, 20 picobarn cross-section for standard model Higgs at our, at least my favorite mass of around 120 GeV. So that's quite a number of Higgs bosons potentially produced already.
Sorry, can I ask, when are you going to start using
that? I think we will, well, okay. Atlas has a result out looking for Higgs to BV bar produced in association with the WZ. And CMS, I think, has a result coming for lepton photon. We'll see. Fingers crossed.
Okay. Because originally they didn't plan on using that at all.
And that's right. And the fact that you can eke out a signal on the tail of the PT distribution has helped quite a bit. You know, it sort of comes out of the background at very high, when the Higgs has high transverse momentum, 200 GeV or more. So you're looking at a tiny fraction of that cross section, but the background is a lot lower at high PT. The Higgs branching ratios are shown here, and the ones that we'll make use of in what I show you today from CMS are the WW mode, which you know, dominates over a wide mass range and has this nice clean final state with two leptons, two neutrinos. The ZZ modes have proven to be, you know, very sensitive at very high masses, over 200 GeV. There are three different channels, and you get very sharp mass resolution in the case where both Zs decay leptonically. The tau-tau mode plays a role, as you'll see toward the end, with vector boson fusion production. And then, despite its small branching ratio, as we all know, the LHC experiments were designed to see the gamma-gamma mode, which the branching ratio for which peaks around 120 to 130 GeV at 210 to the minus 3. No, the colors here are just, I've highlighted it for
so
your...
For Higgs to be, do you have some theoretical error bar?
The error bars are the
error bands on those are quite small.
I don't know the exact magnitude of the errors these days on the branching ratio. I'll show you. So let's start at high mass with the Higgs to ZZ final states. There are three useful channels to search in here, one where both Zs decay leptonically, one where one Z decays leptonically and the other decays to neutrinos, which has a higher branching ratio, and of course the case where one decays leptonically and the other one decays to two jets. starting with the Higgs to ZZ to 4 lepton final state, the search strategy is clear. You look for two Zs in the final state. So we look for two pairs of same flavor, opposite charge leptons, one having an invariant mass above 60 GeV, and then the second lepton pair we divide into two subsamples, one where that second pair has at least 20 GeV, we call that the baseline selection, and allows for masses below the Z resonance shown here. And then we impose a cut at 60 GeV for the so-called high mass selection, that is then that both Zs have at least 60 GeV. Zs or, you know, Z star above the Z. The main background is continuum production of ZZ. And if you look at the predicted number of events here, which is the dominant background, and then compare to the number of observed events, this is in the baseline selection, 3, 6, and 6 in the EEEE, mu, 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 and EE, mu, mu cases, it agrees quite well. We're in the low statistics Poisson regime. And this shows you the magnitude of a Higgs signal for a 200 GeV Higgs for comparison. So that's the nice Z peak in the case where you have four leptons. And then imposing the high mass selection, we get this mass distribution here, shown here. Again, the dominant background is ZZ by far. And then these little orange and yellow signal shapes on top show you the signals for different masses, 250, 200, 150 GeV. And there's good agreement with the background, 0, 2, and 6 events. From this alone, we can derive, and I'll show you a series of these plots, 95% confidence limits on the ratio of the cross-section to that of the standard model. So if anywhere where this dark black curve dips below 1, we've excluded the Higgs, we say, at that mass with 95% confidence. And it just nicks the curve there at 180 GeV. Moving on to the 2 lepton plus 2 neutrinos channel. Here you've got a Z plus large missing energy. And here's the missing transverse energy distribution for the EE case and the mu mu case, showing good agreement again with the dominant background, which is coming from continuum production. Again, this, by the way, shows the expected magnitude of a signal for a Higgs at 300 GeV. It's actually kind of refreshing to see that in these plots, and many of the channels that I'll show you today, we no longer have to multiply the Higgs signal by 20 or 50 or 100 to get it to show up on the distribution. We're getting there. We're getting toward the sensitivity that really matters. So you can see, just with a couple events out on the tail here, the bulk of the distribution is agreeing quite well. So then we impose this cut that the missing ET be above some value which slides up with the predicted or postulated Higgs mass. And this shows the case for 350 GeV, at which I believe the cut is 170 GeV on the missing transverse energy. And we look at the transverse mass between the leptons and the missing ET, and that distribution is shown here. And you can see that the Higgs signal would be quite large in both the EE and mu mu cases compared to the background, which again is dominated by ZZ when you're all done. This channel alone gives a good sensitivity over a wide range, but doesn't by itself rule out the Higgs at the standard model cross-section. In the final ZZ channel with two leptons and two jets, we demand a lepton pair consistent with the Z between 70 and 110 GeV, and then two jets with jet-jet mass between 75 and 105. And then we demand that the ZZ pair mass be between 183 and 800 GeV. So this defines the search region, if you will, for this channel. Now we can subdivide the sample into 0, 1, and 2 BTAG subsamples. The advantage of that is that the dominant background in this case is Z plus jets, QCD production of additional jets with a Z. And since the branching ratio of Z to BB bar is 20%, requiring one or two tags actually, as you can see from these plots, enhances the signal to background. So by separating into these subsamples, we get into background rich and background poor regions and signal rich region doing that. Putting those three subchannels together, we get this exclusion on the standard model Higgs cross section, ranging from 4 to 2 and then shooting up at high mass. Again, not quite hitting the standard model cross section alone. So now we'll move from higher mass down to somewhat. Yes, please.
W plus jets with a Natan phase is not large background for that.
No. No. Let's see, you'd have to have the fake lepton just happen to make a Z mass with the other lepton of opposite flavor. Yeah. I think it ends up being small compared to these other standard model processes. Mainly Z plus jets in this case. In the case where Higgs decays to WW, which covers sort of the intermediate mass range, we exploit the fact that because the Higgs is a scalar, the final state helicities of the Ws are aligned such that the leptons tend to come out in the same direction, whereas there's no such correlation for the dominant background, which is continuum WW production. So we use that bit of kinematics plus other kinematic variables that we can think of in a boosted decision tree, a multivariate type analysis, to extract the final signal. But we also subdivide into the WW plus 0 jets, 1 jet, and 2 jet categories. Again, this helps distinguish signal and background slightly. It's a little bit less compelling than in the Z case, but it still does help somewhat, so we do it. This plot, yes, go ahead. I think there are 8. There are 8 in the boosted decision tree.
Which ones are
important? Well, I think the dominant ones are the ones that I'm showing here. And you can see that we get good separation but using the delta phi distribution, that is the azimuthal angle difference between the leptons, which is small-ish for the signal and large-ish for the background. And then the mass distribution tends to come out small, too, for the mass of the two leptons, invariant mass of the two leptons. Oh boy, a boosted decision tree, if you know what a decision tree is, it gets its power by, in some sense, when you see the outcome of a particular tree, you go back and you reweight the events that were done incorrectly. So you give the incorrect assignments more weight in the next go around. You make another tree, and you keep doing this like 1,000 times, and that's the boost. It was invented by Byron Rowe of University of Michigan. Pardon me?
Is this all automated? And
yeah, it's all automated. Well, all you can do, you check it with, you make a training sample, which is part of your simulation, and then you save the other part of your simulation to check how well it's performing on a completely independent sample. Yeah. Boosted decision trees tend to work about as well as neural networks for separating signal and background. And both of them do better, as you'll see in a minute, than just coming up with the best cuts you think you can. And you'll see about how much of an improvement you get in a second. Now, one thing you start to see here in this plot is that we have a slight excess down here, slight excess in the number of events down in the region where we expect signal, here at 130 GeV. And that becomes relevant later for the result. The answer you already know is that we have an excess at low mass. That same sort of excess appears in the WW plus 1 jet category. Here, there's a larger background from TT bar. So one of the reasons to split it is to push the TT bar background out of the WW plus 0 jets category, making it more signal rich. But again, we see low separation in azimuth and low mass, and again, slight excess down there in the signal area. Then we also split into same flavor and opposite flavor, meaning you know, the W's decay independently. So one could decay to an electron, one to a muon, or they could both decay to electron flavor. That's what we mean by flavor here, muon flavor. The same flavor has slightly bigger Jellyend background than the other. This doesn't bias too much separation, but again, we do it a little bit. We do it anyway because it gives us a little bit of a boost. This is the output of the boosted decision tree, just a number between minus 1 and plus 1. The signal compared to the background separation, you can see, shows up like this. And we get better signal to background for the same flavor, oddly. Good question. I don't know that. I don't know if the plots exist separately for this. Probably they do in the note, internal note, but that might be tough to dig out rapidly. But I could show you later if you're interested.
What's the x-axis?
The x-axis is the output of our boosted decision tree, the MVA, multivariate analysis output. It's just a number. So we're mapping this eight-dimensional input space of kinematic quantities and so forth onto this one-dimensional output, which gives us optimal separation between the signal and the background, or as optimal as we know how to do with a boosted decision tree anyway.
Do you have to go back and see what that means?
In other words, which variables are buying the... Yeah, we try. What you can do is, for example, look at the signal to background ratio as a function of the input variables and see which ones are giving the sharpest turn on or the, you know, the best efficiency. So in this case, you would see that curve turn on as a function. You can see that the signal to background ratio is highest up here where we want it to be. But then you can see how that value depends on the input. The other thing that we also have to study is how well do we model our input kinematic distributions. And systematic errors are handled just as we handle any other systematic error by varying the shapes of those distributions and their normalizations of the different backgrounds and seeing how the output distribution shape changes. So it's done in a really high quality way, which I can explain in detail at some point.
Do you assume the systematic error Gaussian?
In certain cases, yes. For example, energy scales are treated typically as Gaussians. Normalizations tend to be treated with a log normal distribution as the prior probability density. The reason being that they tend to be more log normally distributed than Gaussian distributed. Though it's for small systematic errors, it's not a huge difference to do it.
Was this also the x-axis? I guess I missed
this. So this is W plus 1 jets here. Again, small excess in the signal-rich end of the spectrum. Here is back to WW plus 0 jets, but now showing the MVA output instead. And also, I don't know. I guess you would say there's more of an excess here than down here. Definitely more of an excess here than down here. Could just be statistics. But it ends up reflecting itself in the final limits that we obtain at the end when we combine everything. And in fact, it shows up right here when we... question? Sure.
They're very low spins in both plots.
Have this okay, so
you're not modeling some background.
That's possible. Yeah, it's a
effective
too. Yes. It's possible that there's a background that we're not including properly. Certainly people are worrying about such things all the time. The error bars are large.
You said you estimate your systematic by varying the shape of the distributions of the...
Yeah, so for example, to do a jet energy... Why don't you finish your question, then I'll...
Well, I'm just wondering how you vary the shape.
Right. So what we would do is imagine, so the histogram in the back for the background is the sum of all these different sources, Z plus jets, top, and so forth. So you go to the Monte Carlo, associated Monte Carlo samples for each of these, and you say, what if the jet energy scale was actually 3% larger than we have measured? So you go in and you tweak all jet energies, so this is zero jets, doesn't matter. There are other energy scales in the problem. This is just an example, the thought example. And you run it through all the same machinery. You know, the boosted decision tree that we use is the same. Doesn't matter how we got there, it could have, you know, been handed to you. But the output, the shape of the output can depend on the jet energy scale that we assume on the input. So do it for jet energy scale plus one standard deviation, minus one standard deviation. That gives us a slightly distorted spectral shapes here. And we represent those distortions by parameters which are allowed to float in the likelihood. And we can get rid of them either by integrating them out or maximizing the likelihood with respect to those parameters. And we can have dozens of these parameters. Right. We do include theoretical uncertainties as well. Are any of them related to shape? Sometimes, for example, when we include the effect of initial or final state radiation, we can dial the effect of probability for irradiating an extra jet or not. And that moves actually events from one whole category here to another. And we do that all at once for the same. The whole analysis is, you know, events end up in one of these, I think in the end, one, two, six different final state distributions for boosted decision tree. And the fact that some events can migrate from one to another is accounted for in varying the systematic effects. Basically, we take the attitude that any systematic uncertainty can be represented by a shift in some parameter. And if we shift that parameter, it results in a shift in this output distribution, and also, you know, for the background and for the signal in a correlated way. So it's a sophisticated treatment, I'd say.
So when you show us one of these plots, you've already integrated out some of the...
These are for the nominal values of all the systematic nuisance parameter, typically.
The error bars are statistics only.
Yeah, as is the custom in high energy physics, we put the error bars on the data points, even though that's the only thing we know for sure.
I'm used to that.
You know, if we could, or if there were a convenient way to do it, we should be putting the error bars on the prediction, not on the data.
So these error bars are statistics only.
Right.
And I guess systematics are hard to visualize.
Right.
Not visualized on this.
Right. This is the data point. The error bars on the data points are the Poisson square root of n only. That's all we ever. It just seems to have evolved as the dominant way to do this in high energy physics. If you tried to show these correlated uncertainties, it gets kind of tricky. You have to a shape uncertainty means the whole distribution moves in a coherent way.
What does the PK cut for the jets?
Typically, we use a 20 GeV cut on jet ETs. Whether that was exactly the cut that was used here for optimization, I'm not sure, but I could look it up. Also, for leptons, it is a 20 GeV threshold for PT, typically.
Most trigger threshold is low, 6 GeV or something.
We do have triggers that go that low. That tends to be less useful for the Higgs search than for, say, supersymmetry or other areas.
For lower masses, the cut starts at 10 GeV. So
for the low mass WW?
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
And the whole analysis, well, okay, it's cut-based analysis, so.
Don't
right.
You get tons of data if you do that?
Well, one is 10.
But we do best.
20, so it's a symmetric cut. One is required to be above 20 GeV, and the other can be as low as 10.
2010, yeah, 2010. This shows, it illustrates how, what the improvement you get from using a boosted decision tree compared to a sort of straightforward cut-based type analysis. Now, remarkably, the observed upper bound on the cross-sections doesn't change very much depending on which technique you use. What does change, though, is the expected upper bound on the cross-section, you know, sort of integrating over all possible experimental outcomes. So all by itself, the WW channels can exclude between 150 and 193 GeV and leave us this sort of interesting excess in the low mass range. Not out of line with what's expected statistically, but certainly has gotten a good deal of attention so far. And we'll get deeper into that in a little bit.
About the previous one. Here is only statistical uncertainties. What about PDF uncertainties?
No, there are systematic uncertainties buried in the CLS calculation. I don't know if you're familiar with CLS. It was developed during the LEP era, but the way systematic uncertainties are represented in CLS are CLS is based on performing thousands of these pseudo experiments, looking at all the possible different experimental outcomes with and without signal present. And in the process of generating those pseudo outcomes, you allow the nuisance parameters to vary from one pseudo experiment to the next. And that's how CLS represents systematic uncertainties.
So this excess is over a very wide range, and that's...
That's what one would expect if...
It's really wide?
Yeah. The thing is, we have no mass resolution in the WW channel. Right, we can't measure the Higgs mass because of the missing neutrino.
Same, they have a much smaller fluctuation from WW, but it sort of ends in both at high and low masses. And for you, it sort of goes.
We'll compare them side by side as we at the end of the talk. How broad? About like that. I mean, if you put in a signal, I was trying to find an analog of this plot where we put in, injected a signal into the actual observed data. And what one sees is it turns it from a 2 sigma excess to more like a 1 sigma excess. We haven't approved those plots in CMS, so it's not allowed to show them. But that's what you get. So another way to say that is, even if there is a Higgs present, we still have an excess. So it could be background, could be we're underestimating the backgrounds, could be a statistical fluctuation in the observed number of events. The interesting thing, as you'll see, is that ATLAS sees it too. So that's, I think, what's gotten the whole of people's imagination. Where? Well, I mean, had there been a standard model Higgs at 160, we would have had a whopping big excess compared to these yellow and green curves, but we don't. So, and as Robin is bringing up, there is about a 6% correction to the integrated luminosity coming in the upward direction that we didn't include for EPS. There was sort of a command decision made in the last week before EPS and panic not to include that. It won't affect things too much, but it, you know, probably will go in the direction of making things agree somewhat better with the no signal model.
Are the cuts used here optimizing anyway?
Well, in the sense that for a boosted decision tree, were they optimized in an automated way? No.
What would be interesting to do is to do boosted decision trees and then to learn from that what kind of cuts are really useful. That would improve a little bit.
Cut-based means you're not taking into, you're not putting into play any correlations between the different kinematic quantities.
No, fine, but still the question is, Yes, this cut-based analysis is something that uses a cube in a multi-dimensional.
A rectilinear hyper-rectangle, yeah.
The size of the cube can change.
Sure.
Right.
But the better thing might be to rotate the cube. And that's what essentially the boosted decision tree or neural network does for you. Yeah.
Just left on analysis, whether there are isolation cuts.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Definitely the leptons have to be isolated. And one of the challenges in this analysis was accounting for the fact that additional pile-up can spoil your isolation in unintended ways, right? So we have to measure carefully from the data the effect of additional pile-up on our isolation variables.
In principle, you could do cuts in a correlated manner.
Yeah, yeah. It just gets, you know, arbitrarily complicated, and this is automated for you.
I think what we're all reacting to is it's just would be nice to know what's actually going on.
Sure, yeah. You can do, with neural networks, you can do the same thing. Study the signal to background as a function of the input variables to the neural network and figure out which ones are giving you the separation.
Atlas took us somewhat of a middle ground in that I think they did a cut-based analysis, but the cuts were somewhat of a sliding window, which is a function of the Higgs mass.
Mm-hmm.
But that's what it is here too.
Yeah.
Is that cut-based one?
Yeah, the cut-based, about three variables are actually changing with 10 or is it 20 GeV steps in mass? I can't remember now. So. The masses, the lepton mass, the delta phi, and the lower, the minimal PT of both leptons are changing.
Glad to have an expert here on the WW cut analysis. So, thanks a lot. So then, to very low masses, we exploit the Higgs 2 gamma-gamma final state. As I mentioned, the electromagnetic calorimeter is certainly designed with this mode in mind. Ultimately, we get a 2.4 GeV resolution on the Higgs mass at around 120 GeV, requiring two photons with at least 40 GeV PT for the first and 30 for the second. And then the challenge is to choose the correct vertex. Now, oftentimes, at least one of the two photons converts to an E plus E minus pair, and those are included as photons along with photons that just appear in the calorimeter. We get very good energy resolution on photons which convert just using the tracker. And that allows us to choose the correct primary vertex. Failing that, if neither photon converts, we have to use the other tracks coming from the primary vertex, choose the vertex with the largest PT coming out or something like that. And then the fraction of the time that we get the correct primary vertex is shown here, and it tops out at near unity when the PT of the Higgs is quite large. Now, what we do in this analysis is to separate the gamma-gamma final state events into eight classes. Those where both photons are in the barrel calorimeter versus the subclass where at least one photon is in the NCAP. Then where the PT of the two-photon system is greater than 40 GeV or less than 40 GeV. And then according to whether the photon is isolated or not, using the ratio of the energy in the central calorimeter cell to the total of energy in the 3x3 array, hence the 9 here, that's R9. How much of the energy is in the middle of the 9 cells? So by separating that, this allows us to separate into a background rich versus background poor thing again. So these 2 × 2 × 2, 8 different categories in the final state.
So I know you're going to get to this, but can you just give some idea of how Atlas converts
these? They don't quite do this same set of separations.
But the resolution and stuff. Like
resolution, they're doing, you'll see, I have a plot of their gamma-gamma resolution coming up, which I added. It's similar. This 2.4 varies from across these eight final states. It varies from like 1.6 to 3.5 GeV. So we, you know, in the barrel case, we get very good mass resolution, and it's going to get better in the future, we believe.
How good is a pi zero rejection?
What is the probability that a pi zero is called a photon? Good question. You know, if the better question is what, because the photons from a pi zero fuse. Tend to fuse if neither one converts above about 10 or 15 GeV. We tend to record high PT pi zeros as being a single photon. Now, if one of the two photons from the pi zero converts, does our particle flow algorithm tag that as such? If it sees a conversion whose momentum is pointing straight toward another photon, I'm not sure if that is reclassed as a photon, as a pi zero rather than a photon. I don't know the answer to that. But the better question is, how often does a jet fluctuate to give you a high PT single photon, which is isolated, passes our isolation cusp? This is a very small probability. I'm guessing right now, but on the order of a few 10 to the minus 3, something like that, based on what we've typically been able to do at, in other areas. That's my guess, but I could try to dig out that number if you're... In the luminosity sample that's represented here, yes. 5.6? So 5.6 vertices means that there's an additional 4.6, which are Poisson distributed. Right? I mean, because you're triggering on one, so it has to be one to begin with. So you're already not in a Poisson regime. And then the number of additional primary vertices, and number of additional PP interactions is 4.6. So 5.6 total. Here's the mass spectrum over the full range, 80 to 180 GeV, showing you where our two photons are tending to come from. The dominant source is from two prompt photons from, let's say, T-channel annihilation of QQ bar. And then the fake photon contribution from one real photon and one coming from a jet faking a photon, which is sort of goes toward addressing your question, is in the light shaded green here. Double fakes is a tiny contribution. Drellian appears, here's actually, you know, the Z to EE peak where you've somehow lost both tracks. They've undergone catastrophic bremsstrahlung or something like that and left you with a 90 GeV pair. But we don't care about that, and it's nice to see that we can reproduce it well with the simulation. Now, you'll see that there's a slight excess across this range. I'm guessing that's probably explained by our 6% shift in the luminosity to come. And it doesn't matter, because what we do is we take the spectrum, here zooming in from 100 to 150, and fit it to a polynomial-shaped background, the uncertainties on which are shown in the yellow and green bands around the central value, which is red. The shape of a signal from a Higgs at 120 GeV is shown here for all eight categories combined. It gives you an idea of, the normalization here is arbitrary, it gives you an idea of what to look for in this spectrum. And all is quiet on the gamma-gamma front at present. I mean, there's bouncing up and down due to statistics. But you can't really say that there's a signal about to appear, or I don't know, maybe there's something here going on at 120 for us. Atlas, I'll hasten to add, has a dip in their spectrum right at that point. So I would say this is our first real look at this spectrum with good statistics, but we need a lot more to get sensitivity. Size-wise, good question. I didn't do the extra step of normalizing this properly, but that would be a good thing. Yeah, I'll show you. I can show you that from the Atlas spectrum in a minute, but it's about half. I think about half the size of what we got here, approximately. What we see then in the limits we obtain, upper bounds on the cross-section divided by that of the standard model, is the dark curve here. And we've used two different techniques statistically. If you're a statistics maven, they give basically the same result. We see fluctuations up and down on the order of the size of the resolution that we have, 2.4 GeV. Overall, we expect to exclude a cross-section about just under four times that of the standard model. And the results that we get are quite consistent with this. Now, the final channel from CMS I'll talk about is Higgs to Tau Tau. And the main focus of that has been the search for the MSSM Higgs, especially in the case where you have large tangent beta. And I didn't include all the diagrams, but if tangent beta is large, the BB bar Higgs vertex is enhanced by a factor of tangent beta. So if tangent beta were as large as, let's say, the top mass divided by the bottom mass, 35 or so, it comes in squared, factor of 1,000 over the corresponding standard model type cross-section. So it's a very tempting thing to study right away at the LHC, and we've done so. We've developed very sophisticated tau identification routines here. This reminds you the tau decay modes, 35% of the time to E or mu plus two neutrinos, 49% to a single charged hadron on a neutrino. That single charged hadron can mostly be a rho, 25% kaon, or single pion, and then several charged pions, 15%. So what we do is we try to use our particle flow list of all the final state particles in the event and divide our tau candidate into different final state classes, single pion plus pi zero, for example, from a rho, single charged pion plus two pi zeros or more, and then three charged pions. And for each of these subclasses, then, we have different cuts that discriminate against jet to tau fakes, and optimize that. And we tried it with and without multivariate techniques. In the end, we use the one without multivariate techniques, and it gives us a performance that looks like this, just over about 54% efficiency at high PT for the tau using this loose selection. Now, so I'm going to depart from standard model for just a second here and talk about the result on MSSM Higgs. This shows the four different final states we consider: E plus tau, mu plus tau, E plus mu, and mu plus mu. Meaning, when we say tau here, we mean a hadronically decaying tau that we've identified using this technique, or plus an electron or muon, presumably coming from tau decay. Now you get a nice big signal, especially here in mu plus tau, from zeta tau tau. So that's our sort of standard candle, a built-in calibration for this search. If a higher mass supersymmetric Higgs were to appear, it would appear as an excess on this spectrum, in the spectrum down here, which is dominated by electroweak type background processes, TT bar and so forth. Here is E plus mu, which doesn't use tau identification, also helps us calibrate our tau identification. So by putting all four of these channels together, and we actually also use the mu plus mu channel. Here there's a huge background from zeta mu mu, so this one doesn't add much, but it's a nice little built-in cross-check as well on the muons. The Higgs signal is quite small here compared to the background. Yes? Right. This is the numerator and denominator here is what you're asking. Numerator is clearly we've identified it as a hadronic tau. Denominator means we have a tau in the eta range from minus 2.4 to plus 2.4, and the tau decayed hadronically. So the taus we didn't identify include those that left final state products that were too soft to be selected and so forth. So it's a sort of an honest efficiency. You want to know how to apply this in your Monte Carlo type calculations.
Yeah, I'm curious because 50% is
It's 50% of what is what's relevant, yeah.
Yeah.
Of the sort of hadronic decays of taus, yeah.
Okay, and can you let me know the fake probability?
About 1%.
1%.
Jet to tau. Right, yeah. Jet to tau fake rate. Our multivariate version of this, and the multivariate and non-multivariate are being merged into a unified thing. You can dial the jet to tau fake rate you want, and then whatever efficiency you get is what you get. But, the detectors are so much improved compared to CDF and D0 too that, especially with the granularity of the electromagnetic calorimeter and the tracking resolution and so forth, we do a fair bit better. It's not a factor of two or something like that, but for the same efficiency, I think we get about a factor of two or three in improvement in jet to tau fake rate. But I could show you that in detail if you're interested. Yeah. And there are different algorithms now in both CDF and D0 for taus. Was that a question? This is all of these three. Yeah, I didn't make that. I indented these three to try to make that clear. But
right, it's H minus mu. So what
are
H minus mu?
There's an A1 decay is the main one. A1 to pi plus, pi zero, pi zero.
Yeah, just
sorry, I didn't include that. You're right, there should be another line there. That would have been a good thing. That's this A1 decay. Sorry. I'll amend the talk before I post it. Do you post talks here? Do you want? Right.
Okay. So in the
So for a standard model, that's true. For MSSM Higgs, the triangle, the loop diagram has the enhanced, the tangent beta enhanced factor.
So you can take some benchmark points for the squarks for an enhanced.
They're heavy.
All right, so you can just say.
They're heavy. We assume above a TeV, in fact. Otherwise, as Sally Dawson and company have shown, you know, the cross sections are negatively affected pretty severely. Yeah. Yeah.
Excuse me, and the next slide, this is not visible, this is just the...
Right.
It's not including the neutrinos.
Correct. Now, here I have to confess a bit of frustration. We worked fast this past spring. In the analysis that we showed based on last year's data with 36 inverse picobarns, we were able to fully reconstruct the tau pair mass distribution. But the pile up here got us because we had to correct for that and prove to CMS's satisfaction that we had controlled it. Now, the very bright student of mine who developed this algorithm also had to write his thesis during this time. So that didn't get done for the one inverse femtobarn. He's now working for University of Wisconsin, and it's going to be done, we hope, for lepton-photon in a few weeks. So yeah, you might have seen, if you've been paying attention, apparently you have, we did show a fully reconstructed tau pair mass distribution with a nice peak right on the Z mass and so forth, and we'll have that. And it buys us about 20 or 30% improvement in the cross-section times branching ratio. So yeah. But anyway, I was a little frustrated that we couldn't get this out for EPS, but it was better to get him on to his next job than do that. So, you know, it always eventually comes down to individuals working on aspects of these analyses. So, yeah. So this is what we obtained in the MSSM space of tangent beta versus mass of the A, the pseudoscalar Higgs. We expected to be able to exclude, if it wasn't there, a tangent beta along this red dotted curve here. If you go back to the mass spectra, you see that this slight excess out here in the mu tau channel means that our limits are slightly worse than that. But it's not like coming in a single point, so there's no signal building up or anything like that. And we exclude down to the mid-teens here at 150 GeV, which is very, very impressive. Our previous result from 36 inverse picobarns is shown here. The Tevatron result is here. This is an amazing increase in coverage for supersymmetric parameter space. And it's just limited by statistics right now, getting data, especially out here in the high mass tail.
So do you assume that the H and A are degenerate when you do this, or
yes,
are you more sophisticated?
Yeah, below 130, we assume the little H and A are degenerate, and they cross over, and then it's the big H. We're getting down to low enough tan beta where the crossover is not so sharp anymore. We're going to have to get more sophisticated in the next to go to the next level. But we didn't, by making that assumption, allowed us to just run Monte Carlo at a single value of tangent beta. If we have to cover this grid, then it becomes a lot of computing. Quite a lot. So this comes from Z to Z star H, mainly, at LEP in the MSSM. If you go back to the MSSM search, they presented it in a different way, MA versus MH, and that's the excluded region that they have. But you translate it into this plane, it doesn't look nearly as dramatic. So they never liked to make this plot for that reason, or at least they would do it on a log scale if they did.
At the moment, you haven't separated gluon fusion with W boson fusion.
That's the next slide. Right. So if we impose a cut requiring two forward tagging jets on our inclusive tau tau search, voila, we have a standard model Higgs search. And this shows the statistical level that we've obtained so far. In fact, you know, the dominant background in the mu plus tau case is from QCD. I think we might actually do better by tightening up on our tau ID, reducing that. Here, however, the cross section for standard model Higgs is shown at 10 times the standard model rate. So this is kind of frankly, a stunt that we did just to show that we could do it and that we're gearing up to do it. It doesn't add that much to the final limits, as you'll see rapidly here, but it was fun anyway, and shows that we're in the game.
Dipole tone search, that is pure gluon fusion to Higgs, or is that also?
Pretty much, yeah.
So,
yeah.
Right.
I mean, if you saw that, there's more than an order of magnitude difference between that and the vector boson fusion. I believe that they are including the vector boson fusion signal in the... Another interesting twist came out in the last week about the cross-sections for Higgs with John Ellis's paper. I don't know if you followed this, but there's about a 10% change in the cross-section if you buy their argument. I'm not qualified to judge, but... Yes.
Do you assume that all the superpartners are above the TV, or
the squarks? It's like what we call like M Suzy. When we shorthand down here, M Suzy equals 1 TeV, stands for a whole list of assumptions that are detailed in the paper that I could tell you. The squark and gluino masses, though, in particular, are of that order. I think gluino mass in this case is 800, but I'm not sure.
What I'm thinking about is that if the leptons and the gaginos are lighter, then they could be some background for the... It could just make things...
When we start to get up to 400, 500 GeV, we do need to start worrying about competing decay modes. There's an implicit assumption here that there aren't competing decay modes to the BB bar, tau tau, the standard model particle pair list. We're assuming explicitly there are no Suzy decays of the Higgs here. Is that the thrust of your question, or are you worried about loop corrections? Because that whole thing becomes a giant
like
mess.
Gaginos being neutralinos, or some neutralino tergino or something being produced.
Right.
And then giving the same sort of, and yet just giving...
Well, what it would do is it would eat... Our real experimental result is a limit on cross-section times branching ratio, which we then translate into this plane under the assumption that there are no competing decay modes. Now,
she's asking a different question, but you about, you know, direct production of Chargino pairs or something like that.
We're certainly not including any other production diagrams other than gluon fusion and gluon plus B compensating scattering, sort of.
You did answer my question.
Okay. I can answer other questions. Did you have a different question? No.
Well, I may have misunderstood your question, but I mean, if you had, you know, slepton pair production having nothing to do with Higgs and other such things.
Right. We did not include that.
In any way impact this?
Well, I mean, the only way they could impact is by giving a signal if the thing existed that we otherwise would need to account for, and that would be the problem we want to have, rather. The one we've got, which is no signal. Okay.
So you did include gluon plus
B. Yeah, so glu B goes to B Higgs, and BB bar goes to BB bar Higgs,
so
which is small. But.
Is it worthwhile looking for tau pair association with the B?
Yeah. I didn't mention that, but we did do that here too. We subdivide the sample into the inclusive and inclusive plus B. I was just sort of blowing by the MSN, just in passing, this is showing you this in passing. Individually more powerful. Afterward, I think we have the plots for that, but I'd have to dig a little bit. That show you the limits just from the subchannels. Yes. Well, we include the inclusive tau tau, but it has like zero sensitivity. It brings zero sensitivity. It just helps constrain the background.
Okay. You know, I mean, that's
your
jet jets or forward?
Forward jets. Yeah, the delta eta between the jets is greater than 3.5 or something. So one could kind of be in the central region as long as the other one's really forward. Well, you know, one way to judge that is how well are we able to predict our background? And you can see with your own eyes, you're doing quite well on that. Now, do we get the inclusive PT of the two jet distributions correct? That looks pretty good. If there are other quantities you might want to investigate, we can think about that. Counting jets is always a trick, but you know, you demand at least two jets here. So if there are three, what happens? You know, yeah, that would affect our normalization. The other thing that's difficult here is the QCD we get from the data with the same sign, opposite sign trick, and that then presumably includes things like double parton scattering in a natural way.
Is there some studies by CMS to suppress QCD background by imposing rapidity gap vehicles? Jet beta, track counting beta.
Wow, that you I think are referring to the analyses that we put in our 08 physics TDR. Yeah, we have found with particle flow we didn't need to impose the track gap or the rapidity gap track veto or things like that. Yeah, we didn't use that. We really did a kind of a dumb thing. This is far from optimized. Just we demanded the two forward jets and looked and see what we got and did the background estimations the best we could using the data. This is a data-driven estimate of the background, so and it worked really well. But statistics are poor now. You know, you can get away with a lot when statistics are poor like this. Now, we have pretty conservative systematic errors on the backgrounds here. This is just the beginning of this. All of us working in the Higgs to Tau Tau area have as our ultimate goal doing this analysis, because that's what will be the most interesting very soon. However, as you'll see, well, we get about expected bound around 9 times the standard model cross-section. If you remember from Higgs to gamma gamma, it was down at 4. Well, that sort of comes in squared in the luminosity ratio, right? So this isn't bringing that much additional sensitivity. And here are all 6 CMS search channels on the same slide. And the goal is to combine all these in one giant fit to search for the Higgs at all masses. Now, we form a joint likelihood from all these channels and include all the correlated and uncorrelated systematic uncertainties represented, as I mentioned before, by various nuisance parameters. To give you an idea of how many different nuisance parameters we're considering, there's 143 in total, okay, including correlated and uncorrelated ones across these 6 final states. In the end, after a long, bitter battle with Atlas, we've agreed all to both quote limits based on the CLS method. And I'll just tell you, go look at the Atlas PC, their so-called power constrained limit curves, and see if you like what it does sometimes, which is to exclude the Higgs with zero cross-section. I don't like that. But anyway, the CLS and Bayesian results agree quite well. I'll just sort of leave it at that. As shown on this plot, the blue in the background of this is the observed limit here, is from Bayesian method. But the main result here is from CLS, and you can see that our curve now dips below the standard model equals one line here and over a wide range, extending from 150 all the way up to 450 GeV, except for right there and right there. And maybe right there and there. So it's close, it's tantalizingly close. We had expected to exclude the entire range up to 420, like 125 to 425. Because of this excess in the WW mode, we didn't get down to 125 GeV. So this difference between where we were able to exclude and where we expected to exclude, that's what we got. If you want to see the individual, so this shows that sort of almost looks like a barcode from the supermarket or something, but a little bit more data and we'll have it between about 150 and 450. So the tension is definitely going to shift to the low mass channels here.
Silly question.
Sure.
So we don't really believe we saw the Higgs because we think that maybe those could be upward fluctuations.
Where?
Wow.
I mean,
how do we know we don't have
At 90%, if you're willing to relax your standards a little bit, we do exclude it. Yeah, this is just at 95% and just standard model. Yeah. Where? That would be 20, 10, 20, 30, 40, 140. I'm gonna zoom in on that region a little bit.
That's the WW axis and the 120 bump you have at gamma gamma combined.
Correct.
ZZ. Yeah. ZZ? Yeah. You have one of those then.
How many channels?
We have ZZ at 140.
So, and let's see, ZZ. Doesn't say much right at that point. There's a slight excess. There is what Slava's referring to, I think. I'll bet you anything we don't discover from 150 to 450 right now.
But also an exciting excess at 170.
Excuse me?
Compared to what you were expecting to exclude.
Oh, you meant back here for this?
No, I'm just saying. I'm saying that
individual excludes that's the amount of heat there. You still have an excess with respect to what you are expecting.
Right. I mean, that's a reflection of these excess. Be a tough customer to please. If you want to see where the different channels each contribute, you can see here. I think a couple surprising things to me. I was actually quite pleased to see how well the WW mode did at low mass here. Okay, that was a surprise. Gamma totally dominates below 110, 20, 30 or so, but that WW reached down that far, or that it was equivalent to gamma. Bit of a surprise to me. Tau Tau is, not doing nearly as well as gamma. But nevertheless, someday we're going to need to see the Higgs-Decaying to fermion pairs. And so we're going to need it if the Higgs is discovered at 120. And we'll get there eventually. But it seems to, that analysis needs more improvement. Gamma is getting quite a lot of attention. And a number of us are, dedicated to Tau Tau for sure. Across the rest of the range, it's the ZZ modes at high mass and the WW case in the intermediate mass. Here's Atlas's result. You want to go back to CMF?
Yes. Stupid question.
Yeah. I mentioned in the beginning that hopefully by lepton photon we'll be able to include the BB bar, the boosted Higgs associated production. Atlas has such a result, W and Z to Higgs, Higgs to BB bar, and that's these curves up here. Now, Atlas has expected is dotted and observed is solid. So it's median expected here in each case, and they dispensed with the bands on this plot to make it readable. But you can see that they have a deficit, if you will, in the Higgs to BB bar case, totally dominated by gamma. The wiggles here, again, are coming, they reflect their spectrum. Where is it? Oh, didn't I? Here's the Atlas spectrum. This shows you the width of the signal and the magnitude of the signal at 5 times the standard model cross-section. I guess what I showed on our gamma spectrum should be scaled down maybe by a factor of 10, not 2. To get to the standard model cross-section. But you can see that it goes up and down where you have an excess here at 127 or whatever corresponds to an excess at, in the limit, and a deficit like so. They expected to exclude between 3 and 4 times the standard model Higgs there. Again, for their WW, the red curve, they have an excess. And then they made a similar plot to ours, even with the same icky yellow and green bands. And you can see that the up and down there, which is coming from the gamma, is sitting on top of an overall excess, presumably coming, since it's so broad, from their WW channel. Okay. One thing I can't resist pointing out is that they did not expect to exclude the standard model Higgs in this range, whereas CMS did. So we had better sensitivity overall than Atlas did. So yay, CMS.
Is that because of the analysis? Why is cut-based and another why is the booster decision tree?
There, we're going to have to get into the fine details. We both use the same integrated luminosity. That much I can tell you, 1.09 or so. So it's not in a gross difference like that. It's in the analysis approaches, I guess. So I don't know if we expect this situation to persist into the future or not. We'll just have to see. So there they are side by side. Both experiments exclude 300 to 450. CMS excludes 150 to 200 in addition. Overall better sensitivity. Both have the low mass excess, and I believe the Atlas and CMS combination may be coming for lepton photon. Certainly the groups are meeting on a regular basis. The method for doing the combination is set. In fact, I believe the same code is used to do these combinations individually in the two experiments. So combining them together is almost like throwing a switch. But it's, when do you throw that switch? I don't know. CMS is adding more data, I believe, for lepton-photon. We'll see if that actually makes it or not to Mumbai. And there's the Atlas spectrum. The Tevatron experiments, I'll just show their exclusion plot, which was released last week at PANIC. In the interesting low mass region, the Tevatron excludes no greater than 2 times the standard model, and it's at 2 at about 130 GeV, right in the region of the LHC excess. So what I wanted to do, and it's hard to do because of the way the plots were formatted, but I wanted to overlay this with the result, let's say, from CMS. The problem is that the CMS results on a nonlinear scale here. I think it was like on a square root scale, not even a log scale. So it's hard to.
And I to prevent this.
Yeah. So that's 10, 20, 30, 40. 40 I have overlapping with 50. But the point being that Tevatron alone is still excluding the best relative to the standard model at low mass, and LHC is coming, but LHC is going to have a much bigger increase in the amount of bigger factor increase in the amount of data coming in the next few months, whereas Tevatron ends at 2 p.m. on September 30th, followed by a lab party to which everybody in the world's invited, I believe, since y'all paid for it. Right? So Tevatron, I don't think, this is sort of my now hand-waving speculation about what's about to happen. Next few months are going to get very interesting, and schematically, it's always hard to predict the future, but with 12 inverse femtobarns per experiment, combined everything, dominated by BB bar, though the Tevatron uses the tau pair modes as well, may get up to a 95% limit if there is no Higgs, 118 to 120. I don't know where this curve will land, but it very well could be about here, let's say. Schematically, like that. The LHC is coming in from the other direction, from the high mass, so it's like pinchers coming down. Will we be left with a gap at the end of the year with 4 inverse or 5 inverse femtobarns from the LHC? How far can we extend this curve? I don't know. Also, this curve kind of turns over at some point due to the gamma-gamma is sort of flat. I didn't depict that on this diagram. But you can see we may be left in the situation, especially if there is a standard model Higgs at around this mass where neither experiment can exclude it and neither accelerator can say the Higgs exists at that mass. So, come on, everybody, can't we all just get together and combine all the data in the world? That's kind of what I would really love to see happen. It would be, to my mind, the best way to end the Tevatron era is to participate in a combination with the LHC. I believe there are motions in that direction. I think that the Tevatron folks are certainly willing. We'll see if we can convince the LHC folks. So that's kind of fun. I think that's all I have to say today, but we could dig in deeper if you like. Thanks.
What does that plot look like with 5 inverse?
Good question. Depends on if the Higgs is there or not. So if you say if the Higgs is there, we grind to a halt, right? You shouldn't be able to exclude it if it's there. Now, if you want to put it the other way with p values and this, 2 sigma, 3 sigma,
so
and so forth.
Say what you expect.
Yeah. The analyses are evolving rapidly and improving rapidly. And we're going to do better than we can do now. So we're going to do better than just the square root of the luminosity in terms of the cross section limit. My guess is. I'd be extremely surprised if we could get to a 5 standard deviation golden discovery, even combining both the Tevatron and LHC before the end of the year.
The Tevatron, we won't have our final data analyzed until winter conferences.
Right.
Minimum.
Well, better work fast.
That's the goal. I mean, we have improvements that we're doing, and the the goal is an ambitious goal already to have the final data set by next winter. But they want it to be the final, meaning all the improvements.
The Tevatron experiment, the biggest improvement expected is in improvements to B tagging. And that will buy additional sensitivity equivalent to, you know, factor of 1.5 times the data or something like that. Yes?
From the plot which you show, it looks like you completely exclude Higgs with a fourth generation model.
Yeah, I didn't show any of those plots, but
yeah,
I think.
Just look at this.
Right. Yeah, yeah. I mean, in the certainly the LHC ones go out to like 600 GeV or something. Yeah. Well, unless the fourth generation's. The thing is, an additional fourth generation gives you more cross-section, but also drags the Higgs mass up, right?
Yeah, 350 to 400 or so, the light Higgs.
Yeah.
So, that's
ruled out.
That is ruled out.
I mean, yeah, there are plugs in the There are plugs in the 150 and 120 regions.
Yeah.
Which means it's been pinned down.
Would you like me to bring up the fourth generation exclusion plot from CMS? I think I can.
So you can show us the WW curve, just multiply by 9, and then we divide by 9.
No. We have one from last year for the fourth generation.
Yes.
This is the note on the combined. So long. So here, no. That's this one. Here's the fourth generation. So it goes out. We need more Monte Carlo out there. I don't think we did generate Higgs out there. But yeah, it looks tough for the fourth generation.
But in the minimal supersymmetric model, you get into inconsistency of about 500. So the allowed range is like 350 to 500, given flavor, this and that. And
as always, we're always dealing with the simplest lowest level versions of these things. If you have fourth generation and supersymmetry, I guess.
Well, that's what I'm talking about. If you have a minimal supersymmetric model of fourth generation in there, then Higgs mass is pushed up to 350 at least.
Right.
But above 500, you get into all kinds of trouble. So
you also then have to have its decay modes then?
Yes.
Probably at 350 are similar, then.
Yeah, it's not.
That's not different.
Not contains the fourth generation stuff because your limits on the fourth generation are already such that the fourth generation can't be in the final state. Right?
I guess one useful thing would be to be able to transmit to the experiments what format the limits should be presented in order to allow you to translate into these spaces. I think cross-section times branching ratio bounds, given certain decay modes, is the easiest thing for us. Yeah. And we have tables of those in the.
Is that all the way down?
Where does this cross? It looks like about 120, no vertical line then. Yeah, a little over 120.
Thank you, John.